This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscawen. Physician-assisted suicide is in the news again. Yesterday, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, known as the suicide doctor, helped a 47-year-old woman who had multiple sclerosis kill herself. She died in her suburban Detroit apartment by inhaling carbon monoxide, the 12th person assisted by Dr. Kevorkian. Today in the Netherlands, a new law was passed that establishes strict guidelines which allows a doctor to help a patient die. The Netherlands has the most lax euthanasia laws in the world. The thorny issue of physician-assisted suicide has confounded lawyers, hospital administrators, doctors, patients, and medical ethicists alike. Arthur Kaplan is the director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Minnesota. He also teaches in the university's philosophy and surgery departments, and he's the author of a book of essays called If I Were a Rich Man, Could I Buy a Pancreas? It's his job to think about the current ethical issues surrounding the delivery of modern medicine.
I'd say the major issues of the day are, first, the right to die, the termination of treatment, the pulling of the plug on people who suffer from cancer or Alzheimer's or other diseases, plus the related question of, is it ever correct for the doctor to assist in death, to hurry death intentionally, a la Jack Kevorkian? Another major area is AIDS, trying to deal with the threat that the epidemic poses, not only to the health of Americans, but to privacy and confidentiality and to civil liberties. I think a third major area is what I would call reproductive technologies, trying to grapple with the ability to make babies in new ways, to use surrogate mothers, to transplant embryos, to see women in their 50s delivering babies by means of egg donation. Lots of tough questions there about the nature of motherhood, about what's in the best interest of a child, about the importance of actually having a baby, and who would get custody should a dispute break out. And the last area, and the one that I think is emerging as perhaps the most contentious of all, genetics. The new discoveries in genetics that are coming out almost every week, allowing us to pinpoint the hereditary causes of disease and also of behavior and personality. Questions such as, is homosexuality rooted in some sort of biological cause? Should we test people in the workplace for their disposition to diseases? Should insurance companies have the ability to weed people out based on their genetic makeup? That really is the 21st century bioethics frontier, and I think it's going to keep the bioethicists fully employed for some time to come.
Well, let's talk about physician-assisted suicide. Yesterday, Dr. Jack Kevorkian helped another person commit suicide. This was a woman who had MS. It's the 12th time that he has done this. Did he break any laws by helping this woman die?
Well, he didn't. Michigan has no law on the books that prohibits assisting in a suicide. More than 30 states do. Michigan is not one. The legislature has passed a law. It's very specific to Kevorkian's activities, but it doesn't take effect until April 1st. So right now, technically, he has not broken the law in assisting in these suicides.
Why haven't medical associations removed his license?
The medical association suspended Kevorkian's license, but he's appealing that. I think the reason that they haven't moved aggressively in trying to police his conduct is that there's a tremendous amount of ambivalence on the part of the medical profession. Surveys show about 20% of American physicians admit to having hurried or hastened or assisted in the death of a patient. What Kevorkian is doing in the newspaper, is doing publicly, does go on in a quiet way in many, many American hospitals with the knowing participation of both the doctor and the patient. And so I think to come down harshly on him would be seen as a bit of hypocrisy by many in the medical profession.
What is wrong from your vantage point with physician-assisted suicide? And we can talk a little bit about active euthanasia and passive euthanasia, but where's the slippery slope there?
Well, I think with respect to stopping treatments, withdrawing technology, there's nothing wrong. Patients should be in charge of what happens to them in the hospital. If you don't want dialysis, if you don't want a respirator, if you want to be allowed to die, I think that is your right, and you should have every protection of that right. And in fact, I would argue that we've moved to that position in the United States. The more controversial area is giving the doctor the authority to kill you, to actually do something intentionally that will hasten, that will cause your death. I think there are three major problems with legalizing what Dr. Kevorkian is doing. First, you're in a situation where it's not clear to me that the doctor has to kill you. We may be in a position when we're terminally ill or severely disabled where we need access to pills, where we need access to information, but I haven't yet heard the case made as to why the doctor should be the person who administers the fatal dose or the fatal injection, or in the case of Dr. Kevorkian, the fatal gas. It seems to me that doctors in this day and age are not needed, but people want to get them involved in part because it seems that they want to shift moral responsibility. And I would argue that moral responsibility for ending your own life ought to be in your own hands. Secondly, we've got a system right now, a healthcare system that has 30 million people outside it. They have no insurance. If you look and see who supports the active euthanasia movement, who it is that's in the Hemlock Society, you will find very few poor people. You will find very few people of color. They're afraid of what it would mean to allow doctors the right to kill legally in a system where they don't have the right to get into the healthcare system. Literally, the prospect is there for abuse because we can't have a system that doesn't allow people the right to healthcare but affords them the right to be killed by the doctor. The last problem, I think, is that we need some checks and balances. What Kevorkian is up to is a situation where he doesn't test the competency of the people who ask to die. He doesn't find out whether they really mean it, if their wishes are authentic. And so you've got to have some kind of checks and balances. Otherwise, you're going to attract the depressed, the despondent, people who are disturbed, not those who really do mean that they've given up and they want their lives to be ended.
Does it concern?
I won't say that I think assisted suicide is wrong in every case, but I think it's wrong in most cases. And American medicine could do a lot better job trying to teach people how to cope with illness, how to cope with dying, than it presently does. And I'd hate to let us off the hook by saying, well, look, let's just wind up killing people rather than pushing us to make death and dying a much more acceptable and palatable experience.
Let me get your reaction to a new law in the Netherlands, which does allow doctors to assist in the suicide of a patient or even allows them to kill a terminally ill patient if the patient requests it. There are several guidelines. One is that the request is voluntary, it's not made under pressure, that there is serious suffering with no hope of recovery. Mm-hmm. They have to express that they truly want to die, and there mm-hmm. needs to be a second opinion from a physician. Does that take care of some of the ethical issues as you see them?
It does. I think the Dutch, it's important to know that the Dutch have had decriminalized euthanasia. They haven't prosecuted physicians now for getting involved in assisting in a suicide on request of patients for about 7 or 8 years now. And so they're familiar with it. And this is basically a shift to make what's been going on legal. I think the Dutch have put in checks and balances. They are checking to make sure that the person is mentally stable. They do require a diagnosis of terminal illness that's confirmed by someone other than the doctor who's going to assist in the suicide. They are saying that they want the person to indicate over a sustained period of time that they mean it, that it's not just an expression of despair at a particular moment. I think those are reasonable checks and balances, and they handle many of the ethical problems. The other thing that's true of Holland is no one is seeking out assistance in suicide because they fear that they're going to go broke, because they're worried about spending out their relative's estate, because they feel the pressure of cost containment. That's not true in the United States. And so in that sense, I think the Dutch situation is not analogous to ours. The Dutch have national health insurance. The Dutch are not going to the doctor to be killed because they want to conserve their bank balance, because they fear that they won't be able to pay for the care. They go there when they feel that they really don't want to suffer or they don't want to go through the indignity of the dying process. That wouldn't be true in the United States until we get our healthcare system into some kind of decent, minimally decent shape.
Arthur Kaplan is the director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Minnesota and the author of If I Were a Rich Man, Could I Buy a Pancreas? More on medical ethics after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to bioethicist Arthur Kaplan. Does it concern you that most of Dr. Kevorkian's patients have been women?
Yes, it does. I've commented on the fact in print a couple of times and written that I'm very bothered that the overwhelming majority of the people, not only who he has assisted, but who've contacted him, have been middle-aged women. I think these are people who feel that life has nothing more to offer them. They're frequently people whose children have moved away, who don't have jobs, who find themselves facing chronic illness and sometimes with pain, and they feel abandoned. And it just strikes me as a horrendous indictment of our society if the best we can offer to people who are suffering not terminal illness, none of the very few, not none, but very few of the women who Kevorkian has helped have been terminally ill. Some have had Alzheimer's, some have had chronic pain. Is it really the situation that we want to offer as a society to make life worthwhile for women? Kevorkian's Thanatron, Kevorkian's carbon monoxide mask, I think that doesn't speak well of America.
But this interest in the right to die and an impatient's right to die, does that express a concern in this country, a kind of flip side express from what concern from what you have said, that many times people feel that it's difficult to die in this country. Once you get put into a hospital, it's difficult to get off life support system. It's difficult to argue for what you want once you're in a hospital.
Well, I think that clinical practice is changing with respect to being in control of life support, of all the machines and the technology. I think even 5 years ago, when we heard about cases like Cruzan and Busalaki and Quinlan, that we were frightened and worried that we would be trapped and imprisoned in horrible states, maybe left to suffer, and that the easier way out would be to just have ourselves killed or dispatched. I think that medicine has made some progress on that score and is now in a position to say, no, you can say that you've had enough of the respirator or you want your feeding tube turned off. We've had Supreme Court decisions that affirm those rights. Nevertheless, is the appearance of a strong right to die movement, the popularity and support for Kevorkian, the state initiatives in California and Washington that attracted more than 40% voter turnout in support of the right to let doctors assist in suicide, is that an indictment of American medicine? You bet. It's telling us that we don't deal adequately with pain, that we have too many people dying in hospitals, that people are cut off from family and friends by a system that is basically inept at dealing with dying. I would argue that the solution, however, is not to go out and kill people. For most individuals, the solution is to make a humane, caring system that gives options, that allows one more access to hospice, that allows one to go home, that allows one adequate pain relief, that allows one to have a dignified death without being forced to go into fiscal bankruptcy. This society can do those things. The danger is, as we all yammer on about cost containment and the need to get a handle on escalating healthcare costs, that we're not going to think carefully about doing that because the right to die looks like a quick, easy, simple, and efficient way to solve these problems of terminal illness and dying. But I would argue, as Mencken once said, it looks easy, it looks simple, it's just wrong.
Well, you're really describing the problems with the system, and we have a $800 billion a year healthcare system in this country.
$940 billion.
Okay, and counting, obviously, $940 billion. But does that tell you that in order to get a system that is more humane, is it going to cost more money, or does it actually cost less money?
It could cost less money. The fact is, having the overwhelming number of Americans that we have dying in hospitals, more than a million a year out of the roughly 1.5 million who die every year, dying in acute care settings, in hospital settings, in intensive care units, is madness. And it is fueled by a system that has reimbursed doctors for doing the most. It is fueled by a system that only pays if you're in the hospital. We've got a system that is out of whack. It's basically, to use a Yiddish term, it's severely mashugana. You find people
crazy, right?
Told that when they're severely ill, they have to stay in an ICU bed. They have to remain there even if they're comatose. This is craziness. We're not using our nursing home options. We're not using sufficient long-term care options. We're not sending people home to die as we should. We're not pushing the hospice option as we should, and we're not paying for any of these things. What we've got is a system that says we'll pour resources into you as long as you get the most intensive, aggressive care possible in a hospital. And should you try to get away from that system and have basically supportive care and palliative care, well, that's not reimbursable. I mean, that's just craziness.
Does that tell you something about how Americans feel about death, about illness, about suffering and discomfort, the system that we have in place now?
I think it does. I think the system we have in place now tells us quite a bit about death. It tells us that we don't like it. It tells us that we've made it a stranger. It tells us that we've pushed it out of our homes and into institutionalized settings where we can't see it anymore. And it tells us that we've transferred responsibility and authority to people in white coats. If you ask the average minister or rabbi or priest, what do you know about hospice? What can you say about home care? How can you help families with dying members? I'm ashamed to say that most of these people will not have any idea of how to deal with dying. They view it as something for doctors, as something for hospitals, as something for science. We're a society that, as much as we say we don't want technology and we fear being imprisoned by it, we've wrapped ourselves in it as a way to cope with the fact that we basically want to deny death. We want to deny the fact that we can't keep ourselves vigorous and healthy forever.
What is the connection between this attitude towards death and also our legal system and the fact that so much of the medicine that's being practiced is defensive medicine for fear of some kind of a lawsuit?
Well, one of the things that I've been interested in looking at in recent years is what does the influence of the current legal system and malpractice system do to the practice of medicine in terms of both defensive practice and cost? And the verdict that I've come up with is nothing good. We have a system that is basically saying, look, if you don't do a test, if you don't do things that are of marginal utility or even stretching the imagination on the borders of absurdity, you doctor, you nurse are liable. And we are going to make you liable for not doing everything possible to detect illness or to try and treat it. At the same time, we've got a legal system that operates as something akin to a national lottery. If you have a child born with any kind of damage, why not file a lawsuit and see if you can get some compensation? If you have any kind of bad outcome in a case, you almost always see some sort of legal proceeding start. We need to go to a system that basically takes matters of malpractice and misconduct and puts them both to mandatory arbitration and has some sort of caps on the amount of settlement that can be obtained when there's been an injury or damage. If we had a national healthcare system, we wouldn't have to go to the legal system to allow people to get the money to pay for whatever it will cost to compensate them for damage or injury or disability that they suffered. The legal system that we've got now is having a horrendous effect on our costs. It is not bringing anybody justice. Many people win, but many people lose when they should have come out victorious. And it's not eliminating either bad medical practice or outright misconduct. So I'd say we pay a lot for a legal system that doesn't serve any good in terms of social goals.
How much do you think all these technological changes and even that the medical system that we have now is changing the relationship between patient and doctor?
It's changing the relationship between patient and doctor quite a bit. When I go on rounds now, ethics rounds at the University of Minnesota Hospital, it's interesting for me to watch how little time is spent by the doctor in a patient's room. My sort of mental clock says that the average visit is about the same as length of time as the average network soundbite. The doctor comes in, basically spends 20 seconds or less chatting with or talking with the patient, and relies on the technology, the testing, the diagnostic interventions to get the information that he or she wants. Much less talk, much more readout of computer printouts of various sorts of machines that spit out all kinds of information about the biochemical status of the individual. So we're slowly replacing bedside manner with a kind of distance, having the doctors in communication with the machines. And there's been no attempt to replace this emerging gap in doctor-patient relationships with anything human, with any kind of continuity of communication or care. If you go to a large medical center, I think if you ask most individuals there, they'd have a hard time identifying who exactly it is that is their doctor, because so many specialists come along to manage this technology that it's not clear who's responsible for the patient.
As we move towards a more managed healthcare system, do you see that is going to further erode the relationship between patient and doctor?
Well, I'm worried about that. I know that the proponents of managed healthcare, the idea that we should have health plans that assign us a doctor and assign us to particular hospitals or clinics, believe that this will save money. But that doesn't get to one of the major failings of our healthcare system, the lack of having an identified primary care provider who can act as your advocate. The idea behind managed care is, in fact, to take away choice from the individual patient and basically run the person through the system using the doctor as a gatekeeper, so that you don't have an advocate. You have someone who, in some sense, is almost adversarial to you. I think that you can do managed care without getting involved in those kind of arrangements, but many managed care plans are not addressing this problem of the doctor-patient, nurse-patient alliance. They're simply paying attention to the bottom line of healthcare and not worrying very much about what it means to have good quality care.
I'm going to ask you a question and I'm going to need a soundbite answer. How much should a patient know about their doctor? And I'm talking, of course, about doctors who test positive for the AIDS virus.
I think patients have a right to know everything that is materially relevant about their doctor. If the doctor is going to do surgery on you, you probably have a right to know their HIV status. If the doctor is your psychiatrist, you don't.
And if the doctor is going through a divorce, you need to know that? Or if they didn't get a good night's sleep?
I think if you're, let's put it this way, if your fellow surgeon would want to know whether that divorce or that loss of sleep was affecting the person's competence, you would too. What we really need to know, though, is the outcomes that that surgeon has had or that psychiatrist has had over the past year. We need the consumer reports of healthcare, and that basic information is where we ought to put our emphasis in terms of disclosure about what doctors and hospitals do.
And very briefly, do you feel that the system is going to change? Is there movement towards change?
There is some movement. I think doctors and nurses are fed up with the system. I think patients are fed up, and I think business is fed up. Ironically, the locus of change is probably coming from a kind of corporate socialism, corporate boardroom socialism. The cost is too high. Business and the third-party payers want some change, and I think that political alliance will produce some change. I hope for the good, as long as we keep the consumer firmly in mind, I think it'll go that way.
Arthur Kaplan, thank you for joining us on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Arthur Kaplan is the director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Minnesota. He teaches in the university's philosophy and surgery departments. He's also got a book of essays called If I Were a Rich Man, Could I Buy a Pancreas? I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.